Well, just as the Queen's birthday gave us our last three-day holiday for a while, darn it, Trinity Sunday is our last major feast day for this church year. And as the only feast dedicated to celebrating a church doctrine, you're getting all excited, aren't you? And a fairly incomprehensible one at that, the only rational thing to do is tell a joke about it. That's tradition. Every preacher does it every year. But I'm going to break with tradition this year. And I want you to quiet yourselves, and I want to invite yourself into a place in your imagination. I want you to think of a town or a village by a river. Now, it can be the Waikato or the Thames or the Mississippi or somewhere in Middle Earth. It's your call. But just make the setting one that is beautiful and tranquil, where the soil is rich, the foliage is colorful, and the snow-crested mountains in the distance stand like protective angels. The village is well-kept and picturesque. It still qualifies as quaint, even though it has broadband and cable and some excellent coffee bars. You know every nook and cranny. Your fellow citizens are your friends and family. You know each other's stories, and they weave seamlessly into one story. Harmony is the rule of life, and everyone knows the rules. The river that bends around the village is its source of life. It's a source of food, water, transportation, and sanctuary. It is a place that's been there for generations and generations and generations beyond knowing. It has developed its own rhythm of life that has become one with the people. Its music, art, and language are steeped in its history, and they color the present and proclaim with assurance the future. It is a place where you know who you are. But even in such idyllic places, some rain must fall. It isn't noticed at first that the normal annual rainfall has been exceeded. And that was always just the right amount. But day after day, the rain falls relentlessly. Memory doesn't serve when it rained this much, this long. And still it doesn't let up. The ground becomes saturated. And then the river begins to rise. As it threatens to breach its banks, you and your fellow citizens form sandbag brigades to keep the formerly friendly waters from engulfing your homes and destroying that which you value. But no matter how fast you fill the bags and how high you pile them, the rain keeps falling and the river keeps rising faster. Soon the floodwaters cover your fields, destroying the crops and drowning the livestock. Retreating from the river, you and the townspeople watch with horror from your homes as the waters continue to rise, helpless as your livelihoods are destroyed. You want to flee, but where do you go? Your roots are too deeply planted. You are too attached to this place and the values it enshrines. You cannot leave. The waters enter the first floor of your home, and you watch family photos curl up and float away with the very meaning of your lives. And still you stay. And yet the floodwaters continue to rise, threatening even your physical existence. The groundwater is contaminated. Options for reaching higher ground are quickly disappearing. Soon you will be cut off. Your mind tells you to run for your life. Your heart says, stay, no matter how unlivable the place. Now, using your remote, freeze frame that image. stay there. Feel the anxiety, the despair, the ambivalence. Then you will know how I feel today, for it is here am I, to quote Isaiah in the first reading. In his vision of the holy, he despairs of what will become of his beloved land of Judah if they join in an alliance with the northern tribes to battle the Assyrians. In my glimpses of the holy, a new light has been shed on the church for me. It's not a vision I welcome. The church, like the village, frozen in our collective imagination, is becoming an unlivable place. And the rain destroying it is our ancient way of describing what the holy is. It begins, "I believe in one God, the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth." No, your ears don't deceive you. It's the Nicene Creed, the one repeated endlessly by the church, like falling rain, for 1,681 years, and which ironically defines what we celebrate today, the Trinity. It is our formula for the holy. I don't like saying it is here am I in a flooded church, for it is uncomfortably close to Isaiah's next statement, "Send me to bail it out." The prophetic role has never been one to which I aspired. Prophets have to have thicker skin than most. They never get dinner invitations. Folks tend to cross the street when they see them coming. I never felt comfortable in a beard. And when was the last time you invited the local prophet to the pub for a few frosties? And when you do see them coming, you'd rather toss them into a cesspool. It's not unprecedented. Ask Jeremiah about the experience. And there is a reason for that. The occupational hazard for prophets is that they can confuse the message with themselves. They become all doom and gloom and begin to sound like Johnny One Note. To quote the modern prophet William Sloan Coffin, "There's nothing quite as small as a person wrapped up in themselves, and I might add, in their message." So I'd rather be pastoral about the present soggy state of the church and use some of those great Kiwi-isms I've learned, like, "No worries, mate," or my personal favorite, "She'll be right," and then tell a joke or two and let this Sunday pass and hope Glenn is here to preach on it next year. My problem is that after a quarter of a century of trying to explain the mystery of the Trinity and its attempt to say who God is, I now see that it is a dangerous doctrine of God. It is life-threatening, so it's no joking matter. It can't be ignored. So here I am, damn it. Yeah, you may be thinking, it's boring and incomprehensible and of no apparent relevance to my life, but how is it dangerous? The first problem the Nicene Creed has is it's a creed. Creeds, by definition, are the ultimate barrier to our being an inclusive community. See, creeds are the product of debate. Who is Jesus, human or divine? If divine, is he the same as God? If not, how is he different? If so, how is he the same? Is there still only one God? If human, how can Jesus also be divine? If he is one with God, how do he and God act in the world today? You may be surprised to know that these were all hotly debated questions that would have been common on the fourth century's equivalent of talkback radio. They would have been as controversial as such modern topics as whether or not Rodney Hyde can dance, or whether or not exotic trees should be replaced on Queen Street. In 325 AD, the winners of the debate were declared, and their positions were summed up in the church's creed. That was supposed to end the conflict. It was an attempt to unify the church. The intentions were good, but the hope was not realized. What it actually did was divide the faithful into insiders and outsiders, the Orthodox and the heretic. The Nicene Creed became the line in the sand to intimidate our personal authority to explore our spirituality, and it has been used historically and in the present in very destructive ways. Considering the position I'm taking this morning, we thankfully don't burn people at the stake to defend it anymore, I hope. But we have, and a lot worse. The second problem with the endless repeating of creeds is they have shaped our thinking and our living to the point where we cannot think of God outside the forms they affirm or the boxes they create. They have permeated our land and shaped our values. Ultimately, they've shaped our religion. What's wrong with that, you might reasonably ask? Because the God this creed has given us killed his son, damns disbelievers, subordinates women, blessed the bloody crusades of the past and the Iraq war of the present, brings his wrath on gays and lesbians, justifies literal and spiritual slavery, undergirds racism, encourages subjugation of the environment, and according to conservative Christians in the paper this week, endorses smacking our kids. The third problem is not what the creeds contain, but what they don't. Ultimately, every creed is limited. No matter how it is massaged, it cannot be a full statement of faith. They are only reactions to arguments. All the undebated issues are left out. Issues like there's no mention of love, or living out the Christian life, or living in the realm of God in the here and now, or experiencing the divine in the world or in ourselves. Over the centuries, and in particular recently, we've tried to modify the creed to make it more palatable. The one we use at St. Matthew's right after this sermon is an example. But these efforts are like trying to dam up Niagara Falls with sandbags. We cannot protect ourselves from this God with sandbags. Tinkering with the creeds won't do it. Making the language less sacrificial, less masculine, more inclusive, won't hold it back. We must seek higher ground. Perhaps at this point you're thinking, I'm not alone in the flooded church. Perhaps now we can say, here we are. To test that, I would like you to return to that frozen image in the village and hit the play button again. The waters are continuing to rise, yet this creed and the definitions that arise from it are so powerfully present in our emotions that even when we know it to be a destructive document, killing our souls, we have trouble leaving. It taunts our fears, saying, we will be lost without it. We must stay where we are. Do we listen to it and climb to the roof and pray that God will save us? Or make a run for higher ground? For the sake of argument, let's say our desire to survive wins out, and we leave the village and head for the distant mountains, taking our memories but little else. We discover along the way that it is not the village that unifies us, but our pilgrimage. We begin to understand that we cannot define God. If we believe anything in common, it is that we cannot say God is anything. We can only experience God and describe that. When we do, that is a very personal experience that may help us form a personal creed, but not a corporate one. In our common journey, we may discover that God is not love, but love itself. God is not life, but life itself. God is not a being, but being itself. That insight begins to give Jesus new influence in our lives, not as a deity, but as a man through whom we experience the holy. That experience opens our eyes to the holiness in one another and in ourselves, drastically altering how we relate to one another and to ourselves. Judgment evaporates, barriers dissolve, hope flourishes, the world is enlivened and sanctified. We rejoice at the end of the day's journey for the freedom and sense of liberation we feel. Our joy becomes infectious, and others, not from our village, join our little ragtag army of refugees. We enter neighboring villages and find kindred spirits who call themselves humanists, Hindus, Muslims, Buddhists, and Jews. And together we express relief that the God wrapped up in the Trinity was always too small. We conclude in prayerful silence, humbled before the holy, of which we now know we are all a part, thankful that we can now say, here we are, creedless but alive, creedless but not godless.